I call Senate Resources Committee meeting to order. Today is Friday, February 27th, 2026, and the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present today, Senator Rauscher, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Myers, Senator Klayman, and myself, Senator Giesel. I also forgot to mention Senator Dunbar is online with us. Senator Wilikowski is excused today, possibly joining us on time, but online, but maybe not. We have a quorum to conduct business. Thank you to Heather and Kyla for helping us out today with the minutes and the audio. We have three items on the agenda. They'll go in this order. Senate Joint Resolution 26, support Native Corporation Business Development Program. House Joint Resolution 29, ban on Russian seafood. And House Bill 33, support Native Corporation Business Development. That's not correct. I will move to House Bill 33, which deals with the Board of Fisheries, Board of Game members. All right, so we'll start out number one, Senate Joint Resolution 26. I will invite my staff, Paige Brown, to the table to take us through this resolution.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. For the record, Paige Brown, staff to Senator Giesel. Senate Joint Resolution 26 expresses the legislature's support for maintaining the integrity of the federal AA Business Development Program and preserving full participation for Alaska Native corporations and tribally owned entities. The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act established Alaska Native corporations as for-profit entities intended to promote long-term economic opportunity and stability for Alaska Native shareholders and their communities. Participation in the 8A program has been one of the primary tools enabling ANCs to fulfill that mission. Under federal law, ANCs and tribally owned firms are eligible to participate in recognition of the federal commitments made under ANCSA and the unique structure of the settlement. Through 8A participation, ANCs and tribal entities have created thousands of jobs across Alaska, including in rural and underserved regions where private sector opportunities can be limited. Revenues generated through the program are reinvested into workforce training, scholarships, infrastructure, health services, and other community-based economic development efforts. Participation spans industries critical to both Alaska and the nation, including construction, engineering, energy, defense, logistics, information technology, and the professional services. These activities strengthen Alaska's economy, expand skilled employment opportunities, and ensure that federal contracting dollars generate measurable in-state benefits. With ongoing federal review and discussion of the 8A program, it is important for Alaska to clearly state its position. For more than five decades, ANCSA has served as a foundational economic framework for Alaska Native communities, and the 8A program has been central to supporting job growth and long-term economic participation.
Thank you. Are there any questions about the resolution? Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So while I recognize the importance of ANC specifically for Alaska, my understanding is it's the entire 8A program under review. At the federal level, and I've run into a couple of businesses, usually in road network, but smaller communities that have benefited from the 8A as well. And I'm just curious as to why we're specifically addressing the Alaska Native corporations and not all 8A eligible entities in general.
I appreciate that question, Senator Myers. You're way ahead of us.
Okay.
We actually have a committee substitute. We will first entertain the underlying version, which is version A, or excuse me, N.
Okay.
Pardon me. No, it's A. Sheesh, I'll get this right yet. A is in Alberta. Mm-hmm. Just to span it out a little more. And we have a committee substitute. If there are no questions on A, we will move to the committee substitute. I'm not seeing any. Senator Klayman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move to adopt the Senate Resources Committee substitute for SCR 26, Work Order 34-LS 1420/N as in Ninana as our working document.
And I'll object for purposes of discussion. So, Senator Meyer, you have a copy of version N, I believe. And I believe this does encompass more broadly what you were referring to with wider scope of the 8A program. Well, Senator Myers?
Yeah, so I mean, I do notice that this does go a little bit broader than the original resolution, but it doesn't. It we're still primarily talking about Alaska Native American Indian-owned businesses, which again are good, but the 8A program does go beyond that as well. And so, you know, I'm thinking of a lumber yard in Delta Junction in particular, not an Alaska Native owned business, but he was still benefiting from the 8A program. And so I'm just wondering if we want to branch out that far as well.
Well, it's the 8A program itself that's under review. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're focused on, not necessarily the ripple out economic effects, though those are certainly valid. Senator Myers?
Yeah, well, so this gentleman that I was talking to was having an 8A contract. So it wasn't just a ripple effect. He was a direct 8A contractor. And so that's what I'm thinking about here is if you see where I'm going with that. So.
Well, we will certainly ask the invited testimony folks to elaborate on that.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Good question. Any other comments on the resolution? All right. Seeing none, let's go to invited testimony. And online, I see Nicole Borromeo. She is the president of the Alaska Native Corporation. ANCSA Regional. Thank you. I need to remove my objection.
So are we moving? Are we under the, which one are we under now?
We are under the version N as in Ninana.
Okay.
All
so
right.
Removed the objection.
I removed my objection to version or to adopting version N, and we will go to Nicole Borromeo. She is the president of the ANCSA Regional Association. Ms. Borromeo, can you hear us?
I can hear you, Chair Kiesel. Thank you very much.
Welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Absolutely, Madam Chair. I'm happy to. My name is Nicole Borromeo, and I'm the president of the ANCSA Regional Association. Our organization represents the 12 Alaska Native regional corporations that were established by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, and our board is comprised of the 12 presidents or CEOs of those 12 corporations. I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify in support of the committee substitute for Senate Joint Resolution 26 today. And in doing so, you have brought attention to this very important issue that affects not just Alaska Native corporations, but truly all Alaskans. The committee substitute for SJR 26 reflects a fundamental economic truth. ANCs are not only an integral part of the social and cultural well-being of Alaska Native shareholders, but they are among the state's most significant private sector economic engines, directly employing thousands and supporting billions in economic activity that helps keep our state vibrant. In 1971, Congress enacted the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, establishing the 12 regional corporations and more than 200 village corporations. This structure resolved the Aboriginal land claims of Alaska Natives while creating a private for-profit model designed to promote long-term economic self-determination of Alaska Native people with socially responsible guardrails. ANCs are unique in American and perhaps even global business. They are private companies, but they carry a congressional mandate to advance the social, cultural, and economic well-being of their shareholders, descendants, and communities. They are shareholder-owned institutions in which no individual owner profits disproportionately. They return earnings broadly through dividends, revenue sharing, elder benefits, scholarships, and investment in communities. While ANCs are congressionally mandated to benefit their shareholders, they help power Alaska's economy. Year after year, ANCs rank among the top 10 companies in terms of gross revenue on the top 49er list. In 2022, regionally based ANCs generated upwards of $13.5 billion in total revenue, including $4.5 billion from Alaska-based operations. A substantial portion of these earnings are generated outside of Alaska and then brought home here to support our state economy, reversing the economic model that has characterized our out-of-state investment since territorial days. Those important dollars include within our those important dollars circulate within our communities. In 2022, ANC at the regional level spent $2.8 billion in Alaska on wages, goods and services, shareholder distributions, revenue sharing, charitable giving, education, and taxes. Including direct, indirect, and induced effects, Alaska Native regional corporations supported nearly 25,000 jobs, paid nearly $2 billion in wages, and upwards of $6 billion in statewide economic activity was generated. ANCs represent approximately 6% of the statewide employment and 7% in wages. ANCs supported employment exceeds the total employment in several of Alaska's major industries, demonstrating our role as pillars of the statewide economy. More than 70% of ANC shareholders reside in Alaska. Dividends, wages, scholarships, and elder benefits therefore flow directly back into the state's communities. Since 1971, regional corporations have distributed over $5 billion in shareholder dividends, including $316.1 million in dividends, $17.3 million in elder dividends alone in 2022. Congress has expressly authorized the participation of ANCs and their subsidiaries to participate in the Small Business Administration's 8A Business Development Program, recognizing the federal procurement as a lawful and necessary economic development tool, which some have called the missing link of ANCSA itself. The 8A program is used extensively by defense, homeland security, infrastructure, and other mission-critical agencies. It helps reduce acquisition timeliness, avoid protest-related delays, preserves government ownership of intellectual property, and delivers high-performing, scalable solutions that improve taxpayer value. Put simply, ANCs provide value to the federal government and to taxpayers. The statutory 5% ceiling for small disadvantaged business contracting confirms that the 8A program is a limited and targeted procurement tool, leaving at least 95% fully open to all competitors. These small disadvantaged companies in the 8A program compete in the federal marketplace. They must meet rigorous performance standards, undergo intense audits, and maintain a strong performance ratings systems. Continued contract awards are based on mission success and performance excellence. Merit-based hiring and performance excellence are operational necessities. Mission readiness, public safety, and long-term economic stability depend on recruiting and retaining high-qualified professionals across disciplines and backgrounds. ANC success is built on performance. ANC participation in federal contracting also strengthens the defense industrial base as it enhances our nation's security readiness and simultaneously imports billions of dollars into Alaska's economy. The program has been a win for ANCs, but just as importantly, it has been a win for the state's economy. The committee substitute for SJR 26 sends a clear message. ANCs are foundational contributors to Alaska's economy. They are revenue importers, lawful and mission-critical federal partners, and their earnings circulate directly back into Alaska's communities. The corporate model promotes shared prosperity rather than concentrated private gain. Supporting the committee substitute for SJR 26 affirms the federal statutory law, economic reality, and the measurable contributions that ANCs make to the state of Alaska and to the nation's interest. Thank you for your consideration, and I'd also like to thank Paige for her wonderful introduction. I respectfully urge your support of the committee substitute for SJR 26, and I'm happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Borromeo. Are there any questions for her? Senator Myers, would you like to ask your question?
Yeah.
Senator Myers.
Thank you. So, Ms. Borromeo, it's my understanding you don't necessarily have to be Alaska Native American Indian to participate in an 8A program. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that is correct.
Okay. I'm curious with your stance on this, and I understand who you're representing. Obviously, this is your particular interest, but I'm curious how you feel about the resolution addressing specifically Alaska Native corporations or other Alaska Native American Indian owned businesses, as opposed to all 8A eligible companies within the state, since it appears to me that at the federal level, it's the entire program that's under review rather than just specifically dealing with Alaska Native corporations.
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, we have asked Senator Giesel as federal contractor to introduce the resolution, and therefore it has a flavor which benefits Native entity-owned firms that participate in the 8A program. But you are correct, Senator, the program as a whole is under strict scrutiny right now by the Trump administration, and there is a heightened focus on eradicating fraud, waste, and abuse across the federal government, of which ANCs, including the 12 members that I represent through the Regional Association, also have a firm commitment to see removed from the program as well. But by and large, you do not see rampant fraud, waste, and abuse in the 8A program by Native contractors or the other federal contractors that participate in the 8A program. I think it would be very surprising to know that a vast majority of the contracting firms who are 8A eligible are owned by disabled veterans, the large majority of which are white male firms.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Are there further questions for Ms. Borromeo?
Yeah.
Senator Rauscher?
Yeah. Through the chair, I'm not quite up on everything that we're talking about today, so my questions may seem immature or whatever, but I just want to know is what kind of projects are they limited to, or is it unlimited to? We're talking about federal contractors now, and what kind can they build a $60 million bridge because they're an AA? I'm just trying to figure out what's the scope of what they can, and how is that predetermined, is my question. Does that sound like you understand what I'm asking?
Ms. Borromeo, can you address Senator Rauscher's question?
Absolutely, Madam Chair. And through the Chair, Senator Rauscher, the federal government employs a number of different prime contractors and subcontractors across all of its departments and agencies. However, under the Small Business Act, a certain percentage of those contracts have to be set aside so small business owners can participate. The big primes in the defense world are companies that I'm sure the committee has heard before or is familiar with, including Raytheon, Boeing, General Dynamics. Small businesses will find it difficult, if not almost impossible, to win awards against Raytheon, Boeing, and General Dynamics. So the federal government has carved out a small percentage of government-wide contracts that are eligible for small business firms who have been certified in the Small Business Development Program. Now, the firms, though, that participate in the 8A program do a considerable amount of building. And you are absolutely correct, Senator Rauscher. They do build $60 million bridges. They build many projects throughout the country, including the Sphere in Las Vegas. One of our members was instrumental in providing infrastructure support and construction for that project as well. Many also improve the lethality and the flexibility of the warfighter through different options that they have brought from conception to completion.
Are there further questions?
Follow up,
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you. So I'm trying to get a scope on how is it determined which company or contractor or AA contractor can do what? They have this list. I'm trying to understand the list and who's on the short list or the small projects. How do they determine who's on the large and the small project lists?
Ms. Borromeo?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair to Senator Rauscher. The federal government has a very complex procurement process and identification process by which the agencies identify which federal contracts are eligible for small business consideration. And then within the small business program, certain contracts are also eligible for a fast tracking if it is mission critical through sole sourcing as the primary means by which contracting officers work with different 8A firms to compete for the work. The competition in the 8A program is extremely competitive. It is not easy to win work at the federal level, whether you participate in the Small Business Administration's program that makes it a little easier for the little guys, or in the Prime Awards outside of the 8A programs. These are massive investments of both time and manpower, even to be considered by a contracting officer for a potential award.
And one follow-up question.
Follow-up, Senator Rauscher.
So awards to projects, is that on a rotational basis in the pool of which your limitations are? Or what is the, how is that, do you have any idea how to go about the award process?
Ms. Borromeo?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair back to Senator Rauscher. Contracting officers have to abide by federal procurement rules in the selection and awards of Small Business Administration contracts, including those in the 8A program. They are required to consider normal best practices, including cost, previous track record, the efficiency and effectiveness in which the firm can perform the work on behalf of the federal government. But of all of the different variables, cost and previous track record really guide the federal government in making the awards. There is not a, I guess, equal opportunity in, is how I would phrase it, in how federal contracting officers make awards. So that's not to say that there has to be X amount of awards to X amount of firms. Really what it is the best firms continue to rise to the top for reconsideration because their costs are low, they're beneficial to the American taxpayer as a result, and the contracting officer knows that these firms will perform instead of default on the contract because their past performance record is so strong.
I thank you for your information. I learned a lot.
Thank you. Further questions, Senator Kawasaki?
Yeah, just a brief one, because I think I know where this resolution came from, and it has to do with the Department of Defense and Secretary Hegseth. He mentions in a quote that we have no room in the budget for wasteful DEI contracts that will not help us win wars. Second, he says we're doing away with these pass-through schemes. And I guess I had a question for you about if you wanted to comment on that particular quote that sort of had a chilling effect, I think, on all the native 8A contracts. And that's a lot of it is in Alaska, but there's lots of states that have 8A contracts.
Ms. Borromeo?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and back to the Senator. It is true that the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, is taking a look at different contracts and firms that are performing work on behalf of the Department of War. But Alaska Natives and American Indians are not included in the diversity, equity, and inclusion lens by which the federal government is reviewing its relationships with organizations and individuals. The federal government owes a trust responsibility to American Indians, Alaska Natives, based on our inherent sovereignty. And as a result, the Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled and reaffirmed its ruling through 200 plus years of jurisprudence that Native people do not have a race-based classification and consideration when it comes to federal programs, but rather a unique political status. So we are working very hard with our congressional delegation to make sure that Secretary Hegseth and his colleagues at the federal level understand our place within the political structure of the United States.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Senator Klayman.
It's just, Ms. Borromeo, one of the things that has always struck me about the 8A contracts is when you compare the businesses that are getting these 8A contracts and compare them to General Dynamics and Boeing and others, that the smaller businesses oftentimes are better positioned to deliver the services and produce what they're producing more effectively and efficiently on the as a smaller scale business compared to those other businesses. And so that it's actually a better product and costs less for the government to make contracts with the 8A corporations. Any perspective on that? Have I got any accurate at all, or am I missing the boat?
Through the chair to Senator Klayman, I would agree that you accurately represented the 8A program, sir.
Very good. Are there further questions? Seeing none, we'll go on to the second invited testifier. This is Sherry Beretta. Oh, by the way, thank you very much, Ms. Borromeo, for joining us and answering those questions. Next up is Sherry Beretta. She is the director, Alaska Federation of Natives. She also is the chair of the Litigation and Legislative Committee for Chugach Alaska Corporation. I will comment before she begins that Senator Wilikowski has been on the line since the beginning of the meeting. Ms. Beretta, welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony on Senate Joint Resolution 26.
Thank you, Madam Chair and other distinguished members of the committee. My name is Sherry Beretta. I serve as the chairman of the board for Chugach Alaska Corporation, as well as a director on the AFN, and I chair the Litigation and Legislation Committee for the AFN, serving in both capacities for the past 28 years. Chugach was established under ANCSA in 1972 to serve Alaska Natives of the Chugach region. Today, we represent more than 2,800 shareholders of primarily Sipsiak, Eyak, and Tlingit descent. We are headquartered right here in Anchorage, ranked among Alaska's top 10 largest businesses, and last year we generated $813 million in revenue. I tell you that not to boast, but to make a point. The 8A program is how we got here. When Congress passed ANCSA, it gave Alaska Natives land and a mandate to build economic self-sufficiency, but no economic engine. The 8A program fills that gap. For Chugach specifically, it was the pathway to recover from bankruptcy after the Exxon Valdez oil spill devastated our region. Without the 8A program, I'm not sure Chugach would exist today. Let me tell you that 8A means what 8A means in real terms for our community. In 2024 alone, Chugach returned $32.6 million directly to our shareholders and communities. That includes dividends, elders benefits, scholarships, workforce training, cultural preservation, and economic development in rural Alaska. That money flowing into some of the most remote and expensive places in the United States. In communities like Cordova, there are no roads or in or out. You need to take a plane or a ferry just to get there, and the cost of living runs 40% above the national average. Our dividends help families stay in these communities. But the impact isn't just in our villages. It's right here in Anchorage and across the state. Our corporate headquarters employs Alaskans in good-paying professional jobs. We're acquiring businesses in Fairbanks, building workforce housing in Valdez, and investing in community infrastructure in Anchorage. The 8A program imports income into Alaska. Revenue we earn performing federal contracts across the country and around the world comes home to this state through paychecks, dividends, scholarships, and reinvestment. That money would not otherwise be part of Alaska's economy. And this isn't just about Chugach. Across all 12 banks of regional corporations, as Nicole said in her testimony, we're talking about more than $90 billion in combined annual revenues, over 15,000 jobs in Alaska, a statewide payroll exceeding $950 million, and more than $3 billion in cumulative dividends distributed to Alaska Native shareholders. These corporations are among the largest employers and economic drivers in the state. It's also important to note that the Alaska Federation of Natives is seeking to amend SJR 26 to include Alaska's 229 federally recognized tribes. Tribally owned businesses participate in the 8A program under the same federal trust responsibility. And for many tribal governments, 8A contracting is one of the few tools available to fund government services, create local jobs, and build an economic independence in their communities. ANCs and tribes are united on this. Protecting 8A protects all of Alaska Native Country. This isn't just an Alaska issue, it's a national security issue. A recent Washington Times article said it plainly. America cannot survive without Alaska. Our state holds significant quantities of 49 of the 50 minerals the federal government considers critical. Fort Greeley is home to our nation's only defense against intercontinental ballistic missiles. And Alaska Native Corporation contractors keep that system running. Even the Department of Defense recognizes this. A recent Arctic readiness report recommended expanding ANC contracts for remote operations and defense infrastructure. When you weaken the 8A program, you don't just hurt Alaska, you weaken our national defense. I also want to speak to something personal. We invest heavily in education, scholarships, internships, apprenticeships, our Nootchik Spirit Camp that connects our youth with elders on Nootchik Island at Hinchinbrook, and leadership development programs that build the next generation of Alaska Native leaders. Alaska Native people have the highest rate of military service of any ethnic group in the country. We are committed to both our heritage and success of our nation. The 8A program honors that commitment. Now, some in Washington are calling 8A a DEI program. Our participation in the 8A program is not DEI. It is rooted in the federal trust responsibility that Congress's constitutional authority over Indian affairs. Senator Murkowski said it clearly in a recent Senate Indian Affairs hearing. The 8A program was not based on race. It was based on DEI. No, that's not right. Sorry, my notes got messed up though. So just to summarize, SJR 26 is the legislator's chance to speak with one voice. Support of the 8A program is not partisan, it is Alaskan. When our corporations succeed, we create jobs in Alaska, we invest in our communities, and we strengthen our state's economy. I urge you to support this resolution, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Beretta. Are there questions for Ms. Beretta? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for joining us today. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony. Is there anyone in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Joint Resolution 26? Seeing no one, I am looking online. I see no one to testify who has signed up online either. So at this time, I will close public testimony, and we will set this bill aside for consideration at a future meeting. I will be set an amendment deadline for next Wednesday, that's March 4th, at noon. Next up, we have House Joint Resolution 29, Ban on Russian Seafood. So we are hearing this resolution for the first time, and I would invite Representative Louise Stutz to the table, along with her staff, Matt Greening. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you would introduce yourself for the record and present the bill for us. Welcome.
I would be delighted to do so, Madam Chair. Thank you for the invite and the opportunity to present House Joint Resolution 29. Thank you again, Madam Chair, and the members of the Senate Resource Committee for the opportunity to present today. For the record, my name is Louise Stutz, and I represent Kodiak, Cordova, Seward, and many smaller coastal communities. As a member of the Joint Legislative Seafood Task Force and the chair of the Fisheries Committee, it's my pleasure to bring House Joint 29 before you today. This legislation calls on our federal government to continue the ban in Russian seafood imports into the United States that is set to expire later this year. I won't read the the statistics in the resolution, but our seafood industry is a massive economic driver for Alaska. It's the state's largest private employer, and it's essential for the health of our coastal communities. Our fishing industry is facing unprecedented challenges, many of which are outside our control as legislators. This issue is within control, and passing this resolution is one of the best ways we can support our coastal economic, our coastal economy, Alaska fishermen, and our model of sustainable management. With that, I will hand the rest of the introduction over to my staff, Mr. Matt Greening.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Matt Greening, staff to the House Fisheries Committee. There's a redline version in members' packets and on basis showing the changes between the root version and the bill before you, version A or I.A. I won't go through those changes, but they came directly from the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute and folks that work on these issues in D.C. They're just an adjustment of some of the numbers and a little bit of the language from the root version. HJR 29 calls on our president to extend executive orders 14024, 14068, and 14114, which prohibit the import of Russian seafood into the U.S. Executive Order 14024 was originally implemented in 2021 and was expanded by Executive Orders 14068 and 14114, and was extended on April 10th, 2025 for a period of 1 year. That is currently set to expire, the ban on Russian seafood imports, on April 15th, 2026 of this year. Without the ban on Russian seafood imports, Alaska's seafood industry will continue to face a serious existential threat. Russia's unfair trade practices and market practices, state-subsidized fishing fleet and processors, as well as the dumping of unsustainably managed seafood onto international and domestic markets have placed our fishermen in a really tough spot. These bans have been effective so far. They're having a positive impact on market conditions that we saw last year with the market rebound in some of the fisheries markets. And we finally got to the point this last winter where Russian seafood is out of retailers and out of grocery stores in the U.S. Particularly with the uncertainty surrounding negotiations in Ukraine, I believe it is critical that we send a clear message to the president, our congressional delegation, that the Alaska legislature and our fishermen need that ban on Russian seafood imports to stay in place. And I would remind committee members that Russia has had a ban on Alaskan seafood imports since 2014. The resolution calls further calls on President Trump, federal agencies, our congressional delegation, and the United States Congress to enhance federal enforcement of the executive orders to ensure fair trade, protect Alaska's seafood industry, and promote sustainable and ethical seafood production. And what that really means is better enforcement. Only so many of these containers are inspected, so part of the resolution is calling for increased enforcement to make sure we're catching anything that might be getting in. As the Representative Stute said, this resolution is also very timely and time-sensitive, and the goal here is to get it to the president's desk before that ban on Russian seafood is set to expire later this year. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Greening. Are there questions from committee members? Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. I had a question on how one would know if Russia was the catcher of a particular fish. Because, you know, like we export fish to places like China, and they're processed there and then sent back to the United States. So how would we know?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki. So I will say that Executive Order 14114 addressed that directly. Russia was having their seafood processed in China and then shipped to the U.S. How we would actually know that's the case, with the chair's permission, I'd like to defer that question to Jeremy Woodrow with the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. He's here in the room and has a little more familiarity with the details on that.
Very good. Yes, he is part of our invited testimony. If you could wait, Senator Kawasaki.
Yep.
Further questions? Seeing none, I will thank you very much for the presentation and invite Jeremy Woodrow forward, Executive Director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. Welcome, Mr. Woodrow.
Good afternoon, Chair Giesel and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeremy Woodrow. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute. I did prepare a written testimony today, but I think Matt stole all the thunder there and said everything I'd prepared. So I think I'll go a little off script here and tell you why this resolution is really important. We know in 2023, when the ban first went into effect, prohibiting Russian seafood from coming into the U.S., that there was a loophole that was created. And that loophole was that Russian seafood could still go through China and then come to the United States. And they were taking advantage of that. Thankfully, our delegation in D.C. raised the alarm, and that loophole was closed with a second resolution. What happened in that time was that there is a grace period to still allow seafood by way of China to still come into the U.S. And we do have some data that tracks that, and we saw a spike in imports happen right at the end of that 2023 year. What we were told anecdotally and kind of what we saw through a little bit of the imports, that there was a stockpiling of Russian seafood in the U.S. marketplace. And this also happened around probably the worst possible time period in our industries has ever faced. Every single species was facing a depression in prices. There was a lot of other threats beyond Russia that was impacting the price of our fish across the dock as well in the marketplace. Consumers also were facing inflationary spending pressures as well, too, and honestly just stopped buying fish. It was a terrible time to be in Alaska, commercial fishermen, or to participate in the Alaska seafood industry from a financial aspect. What we also knew through the stockpiling was that it would take a while for this seafood to leave the U.S. marketplace. And as Mr. Green said earlier, we just started in the last year to see that inventory start to leave. And how we know this is really through, I would say, anecdotal evidence and conversations with seafood companies, through their approach to ASME as a marketing organization, or through their conversations with Alaska seafood producers, is they're now saying, okay, we're out of our inventory. We're now 100% sourcing Alaska seafood products. Let's talk business. Let's talk about how we can promote Alaska products to the U.S. consumers. Let's talk about how this will change our business operations. And it took a while, right? It was 2024 when this ban was supposed to go into effect. It wasn't until, let's say, late summer, fall 2025, when these conversations started fully coming into play. The challenges we have is due to the seasonality and the volatility of our fisheries, right? Not every year is a perfect season. Our seasons kind of come and go as well. And so the timing to be able to really get our products into the market and also respond to consumers' needs, there's a little bit of lag. It takes a little bit of time. So why this ban is important is we need more time. We need more time to really capture the U.S. marketplace. Our industry has not recovered yet. Even when we look at last year was a better year than the previous year, it was still one of our worst years in the last 20 years from an ex-vessel price standpoint. So what we've been saying is good is not better, and we're nowhere near restoring our seafood industry to the strength that it was and the strength that it needs to be. This is one measure that will help our fishermen. We're starting to see the fruits of this ban coming into play, but we need more time to provide stability to our industry. We need more time to really see it come to fruition. And as Mr. Green pointed out too, we have been able to enter the Russian seafood market since 2014. It's only a matter of fairness that we prohibit their products from entering into the U.S. market as well until better relations can maybe be found in the international marketplace. And I'll open up to any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you for that excellent presentation. Any follow-up on that, Senator Kawasaki? All right. Other questions for Mr. Woodrow? Question.
Would you like me to address this question about traceability?
I thought you already had.
Yes, if you would.
Sure.
So sorry to go. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, your question about traceability, it is challenging through the Chinese markets. There are different traceability standards that exist in the marketplace to help ensure product that enters into a certain market is the product that exists. A lot of that is third-party standards to ensure that. One of those standards that we use here in Alaska is the Certified Seafood International Program. It's a third-party traceability standard. It's also a sustainability standard. And those products, which nearly every single Alaska species adheres to, not all of them need to, I guess I should say, but those ones that do have a significant volume have that certification standard, and you can trace that through the marketplace. Russian seafood does not carry that, and it can be mislabeled in foreign markets. And so banning that import into the U.S. Actually allows easier traceability of U.S. products instead of Russian products.
Thank you.
Very good. I see no further questions. Thank you very much. We have a second invited testifier, and that is Julie Decker, president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and she is online. Ms. Decker, welcome. If you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Mike, can you hear me okay, Madam Chair?
Yes, loud and clear.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. For the record, my name is Julie Decker, and I live in Wrangell, and I'm president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association, or PSPA. PSPA is a trade association which represents major seafood processors with 50 facilities in 22 coastal communities from Ketchikan to Cordova to Kodiak, Unalaska, and Bristol Bay. PSPA companies buy fish from thousands of independent commercial fishermen across the state and in almost every fishery. The health of the seafood industry is critical to Alaska as it generates $6 billion in economic activity annually, creates 48,000 direct jobs, is the state's largest manufacturing and export sector, and also lowers the cost of transportation for all Alaskans. PSPA strongly supports this resolution, HJR 29, as it's one of the few levers that we can pull to protect the Alaska seafood industry from unfair competition from Russia in the U.S. domestic market. Further, more must be done to address the severe negative impacts of Russia's acts, policies, and practices, which restrict U.S. commerce and greatly disadvantage the Alaska seafood industry in domestic and export markets across the globe. Let's remember how we got here. In August 2014, Russia first prohibited imports of U.S. seafood as a countermeasure to U.S. sanctions against Russia after it invaded and annexed a part of Ukraine. Therefore, U.S. seafood has not had access to the Russia market for almost 12 years. Yet, through May 2024, imports of Russian seafood into the U.S. Market continued to climb. This is the exact opposite of fair trade for the U.S. seafood industry. In 2023, the Alaska seafood industry faced historically challenging economic conditions. NOAA estimated losses felt by Alaska in 2023 was $1.8 billion. Russia's actions were a critical part of this economic downturn that Alaska felt, as Russia is a prime competitor with Alaska seafood. Because of our proximity, we both harvest wild salmon, wild crab, wild cod, and wild pollock, which compromised the majority of the seafood harvested in Alaska. Additionally, Russian salmon and pollock fisheries are certified as sustainable by MSC, the Marine Stewardship Council, and Russia sells its salmon as, quote, Pacific salmon, and pollock as, quote, Alaska pollock, further eroding the ability of consumers to differentiate it from Alaska seafood in the marketplace. In 2024, the complete ban on all Russian seafood began in May, although increased imports of Russian seafood flowing through China into the U.S. just prior to the ban meant that, in reality, Russian seafood was still on U.S. shelves until approximately January 1st, 2025. Throughout 2025, the prohibition of Russian seafood has helped to begin stabilizing the Alaska seafood industry. What's even more disturbing during this period, since 2014, Russia, China, and North Korea have been investing in the strategic development of a seafood hub that consists of building new infrastructure for the harvest, movement, processing, and trade of seafood in the region where the three countries share a border. For example, in the Hanshin port on the Tumen River, new seafood processing facilities, roads, railways, and ports have recently been built, making the movement of Russian harvested seafood into Chinese processing facilities and shipment of finished goods very efficient. As well, it's been reported recently that North Korean workers are being used on fishing vessels, Chinese fishing vessels, and processing facilities. This level of strategic cooperation and investment in a region where environmental and labor standards are well known to be far below U.S. standards are examples of seafood production that leaves U.S. seafood companies non-competitive. In 2026, there are still many unknown risks related to trade and tariffs. However, if the prohibition on Russian seafood imports is extended, this will provide some continued stability in the U.S. domestic market. Additionally, until U.S. seafood has access to the Russian market, maintaining this prohibition will help the U.S. gain competitiveness, which is the goal of President Trump's executive order titled restoring American seafood competitiveness. Thank you for your time today and for your consideration of this important resolution. And if you have any questions, I'll stay on the line.
Thank you, Ms. Decker. Do committee members have any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. At this time, I'm going to open public testimony on House Joint Resolution 29. Is there anyone here in the room that wishes to testify on HJR 29? Seeing none, I'll turn to the online, and I see Bruce Schachtler calling in from Kodiak. Mr. Schachtler, welcome to the committee. Invite you to introduce yourself for the record. Let us know what your any affiliation is, and your testimony will be allowed for 2 minutes. Welcome.
Well, yes, ma'am. Thank you for allowing me to testify here. I think there's been enough said. It's a pretty simple resolution, but I imagine everybody understands quite clearly from their lack of questions to the previous folks. But I live in Kodiak. I'm a commercial fisherman for the last 50-some years. The last 30 years, I've been involved with everything from marketing to regulations from Washington, D.C., all the way to the Alaska governor's office and back again. So I'm pretty familiar with this. Julie covered so much of it. We've seen the effects of it. You could go on and on with some of the other effects, such as, you know, when they produce triple the amount of pink salmon that we produce and turn around and sell it for half the price that we're trying to break even with. Those are just so many things that, this resolution will help with. It's not a cure-all. It's a world market. There's still a way for them to affect everything else that we do in the world. However, it will help with our domestic market, which is the largest seafood market in the world. So to me, this is fairly simple. I hope you guys feel the same way, because it's a really big deal. And I hope we can just get this passed and move it on to the president. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Schachtler. Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Schachtler? Seeing none, thank you very much. I see no one else online to testify on this resolution, and so at this time, I will close public testimony. I am setting an amendment deadline for this resolution for next week, Wednesday, March 4th at noon. And at this point, we'll set the resolution aside. Next up is House Bill 33, Conflict of Interest, Board of Fisheries and Game. Today, we will hear this bill for the first time. I will again invite Representative Louise Stutz and her staff, Matt Greening, to the table to present the bill. Welcome again.
Thank you, Chair Giesel. I certainly appreciate it. And thank you to the committee here for this opportunity. For the record, once again, I'm Louise Stutz, serving Kodiak, Seward, Cordova, and several smaller coastal communities. Some of you may not know, but I will let you know that House Bill 33 is near and dear to my heart. It's a bill that I've been carrying on behalf of the fisheries stakeholders since 2018. Actually, I think it might have even been before that, but this bill is a sorely needed piece of legislation. This bill is about fairness for all user groups on the board of fish, as on the board of fish and game, as far as being able to participate in the discussion as a board member. It's not a complicated bill. It's actually quite simple. All the bill does is say that when you have a declared personal or financial conflict of interest involving you or your immediate family member, you may continue to deliberate on that proposal, but will be unable to vote on the matter. Currently, conflicted board members are required to recuse themselves from the table when they have a conflict, sit as a member of the public, and they can no longer offer their expertise during deliberations. This has led to a disenfranchisement of certain user groups, qualified folks for not putting their qualified folks have chosen not to put their names in as a board member for a board seat because of this situation. And additionally, decisions are being made without all of the information being heard. So it's, again, it's really quite a simple bill, and it just allows a leveling of the playing field, so to speak. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it once again over to my Chief of Staff, Matt Greening.
Welcome, Mr. Greening.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record again, Matt Greening, staff to Representative Louise Stutz. Before you was House Bill 33, Conflict of Interest for the Board of Fisheries and Board of Game. This legislation would allow members of the Board of Fisheries and Game to deliberate on proposals for which they have declared a personal or financial conflict of interest according to AS 3952, which is the Executive Branch Ethics Act. As the representative mentioned, currently board members are required to divulge the conflict if their or their immediate family members are involved in the subject being deliberated on. The conflicted members can no longer vote and unfortunately cannot speak on the proposal. They must leave the table and sit with the public. Consistent with current law, House Bill 33 still precludes a conflicted member from voting and only allows them to impart their knowledge of a particular fishery or hunt before they properly recuse themselves from the vote. The qualifications to appointment to the Board of Fisheries and Board of Game are quite different from professional licensing boards. Instead of being chosen as professionals in their field, members are selected based on their knowledge and ability in the field of action of the board and with a view to providing diversity of interest and points of view in the membership. However, how can anyone benefit from knowledge or different points of view if they are not allowed to be shared? Shouldn't resource management be based on the use of all available information? Often in fishing, financial or personal ties of a member or their immediate family members are specifically tied to the knowledge of that fishery or that hunt. A person who has an aunt, uncle, or a brother who owns a certain type of fishing permit, or even owns a permit themselves, may be the only person on the board who understands the nuances of what's being discussed in a particular proposal. Likewise, a board member whose family member or guides or lodge owners may be the only member who understands how that hunt or fishery is prosecuted. Particularly in rural Alaska, where entire families may be involved in guiding or commercial fishing, the current policy is discouraging qualified applicants to the board based on being conflicted out of many of the discussions and proposals before them. Another concern with the current conflict of interest policy is transparency, public trust, and the public process. Board members who are conflicted out will still sometimes offer their input to other board members, but are doing so off the record, and I would pose that is not the intent of the Ethics Act, and that we need laws that encourage transparency instead of backroom conversations. Both the Board of Fisheries and the Game are tasked with allocating Alaska's most precious resources, and it's the sponsor's intent that board members have all the available information at hand on the record when making a decision. Finally, the selection process for these two boards are highly contentious, and the composition represents a delicate user group balance between the public, the legislature, and the governor. When a person who represents part of that balance is silenced during final deliberations, when amendments and changes are made, when proposals are fine-tuned, the integrity of that process is eroded. The two groups in opposition to this bill claim that members can already testify on a proposal as a member of the public earlier in the process. Although that is true, that would be akin to asking a member of this committee to testify on a bill during public testimony and then step down from the table during committee discussion, amendments, and voting. Final board deliberations are when amendments are proposed, allocative and statutory nuances are discussed, and is the exact time that you do not want a member with particular knowledge of a fishery or hunt silenced. Further, this does not create an advantage for anyone, but simply levels the playing field for all user groups and ensures that expertise is brought to bear when changes are brought to proposals. To give the committee an idea of scope of the recusal rates, the Board of Fisheries recusal rate was 28% in the 2021-2022 board cycle, 27% in the 2022-2023 board cycle, and as a snapshot in time, in 2018, Board Chairman John Jensen was conflicted out of one-third of the proposals at the statewide FinFish meeting due to his familiar ties with both commercial and sport fishing. I would note that over the years that we've carried this bill, there have only been two stakeholder groups and one individual that have testified against this. On the support side, we have letters of support from many individuals across the state, as well as more than 20 industry and member groups, including the Resident Hunters of Alaska, Homer Charter Association, the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation, the Native Village of False Pass, United Fishermen of Alaska, Pacific Seafood Processors Association, Cordova District Fishermen United, and many, many more. Simply put, Madam Chair, this bill is widely supported by Board of Fisheries stakeholders. In closing, Madam Chair, this legislation still precludes the conflicted members from voting. It just allows them to impart their knowledge during final deliberations on a board proposal. The sponsor believes that allowing members with expertise in particular fields to deliberate will help the boards make more informed decisions, lead to stronger resource management statewide, and will align process with intent as far as board members benefiting from other members' knowledge or diversity of viewpoints. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for the bill sponsor staff? Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thanks for presenting the bill. I have a question about being conflicted out in that process. And so if I were on the Board of Fish and we were discussing the Copper River dipnet fishery, and I'm a Copper River dipnetter, you're saying I would have to declare the conflict, not be able to vote for or against the situation, and also not be able to deliberate?
Correct. Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, that's not exactly correct in that particular instance. If it's just participating in a fishery, advice from the Department of Law previously has been that that is a right available to everyone to fish on the copper, to fish on a particular fishery. So it's been more difficult to prove a personal financial conflict when it comes to somebody simply fishing on a river. It's more tied to your membership in an organization.
Or from Through the chair, if I might, or a permit holder.
Okay. So I guess to follow up that, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, so I'm trying to understand, like, circumstances where a person would be conflicted out, and is that if their relatives were to have a financial interest or a permit in that particular fishery, what if they don't fish it? Would that still be qualified as a personal interest?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, there's a variety of sidebars to this. So there's a financial interest, which is considered significant if it's $5,000 or more. So if you have you or your immediate family member has a financial interest, then that threshold is $5,000 or more. A personal interest has been a little bit more difficult to prove. And let me pull up my statutes here so I can. So a personal interest is found in AS 3952-960-18. And that means an interest held or involvement by a public officer or the immediate family member or parent, including membership in any organization, whether fraternal, nonprofit, for-profit, charitable, or political, from which or as a result of which a person or an organization receives a benefit. And benefit is then defined in AS 3952-960 again to mean anything that is to a person's advantage or self-interest, or from which a person profits regardless of financial gain, including any dividend, pension, salary, acquisition, agreement to purchase, transfer of money, deposit, loan, or loan to guarantee, promise to pay, grant, contract, lease, money, goods, services, privilege, exemption, patronage, advantage, advancement, or anything of value. It's a pretty broad definition.
Okay.
Follow up, Senator Kawasaki.
So, again, back to the dip netting issue. If I were part of the Chitna Dip Netters Association and also a Chitna dip netter and have a permit, would that disqualify me from participating in that discussion and in voting on that issue?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, I believe that would depend on – so the way the process works is there's basically an advisor from the Department of Law that's attached to the Board of Fisheries. That person works in conjunction with the ethics supervisor to look at these and determine whether there's a conflict. It's very complicated, but yes, if you were a member of an organization that was advocating for a certain change, or you were a member of an organization that so let's say you were a member of the Chitna Dipnetters, and there was a proposal that came up and you were a board member and it came up before the Board of Fish, it's very possible you would be conflicted out of that, yes. but it really depends on the discussions between the ethics supervisor and the Department of Law. It's a very involved process. They have to, some of the board members spend, and pardon me if this is too long of an answer, spend months working on these and getting them to the board ahead of time, and then they work through them.
Great. Thank you very much for the answer.
Of course. Senator Rocha.
Yeah, thank you. So just
Pardon me. Senator Myers had his name up first.
Okay.
I'm sorry. You'll be right after. Sorry.
It's all good.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, given the high rates of recusal that you mentioned, have we ever run into cases on the Board of Fish in particular where enough people have conflicted out that we've lost quorum?
Through the chair, Senator Meyer, that's an excellent question. I do not believe so, but we do have, I believe, Art Nelson from the Board of Fisheries online. Mm-hmm. He might be a better person to answer that question, not to the best of my knowledge.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Myers, he is under invited testimony. If you could just wait, I believe Senator Rauscher has another question, and then we can go right to Mr. Nelson.
Sure.
Senator Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to follow up on what Senator Kawasaki was talking about. But there is a group, there's a business out there which will set you out on the rocks for X amount of dollars. Okay. Now, if that person was to sit on the board, he's excluded from a testimony?
Through the chair, Senator Rausser, that would kind of depend on the advocacy of that organization and the status of the member in question, whether they're still a member on the board. And also, there has to be some kind of benefit. So if you received any sort of a benefit from that organization as a result, or as a result of that fishery staying open as a member of that board, I believe that would be a conflict. But again, I think that is something that would need to be determined. It would probably be disclosed, and then the ethics supervisor and the Department of Law folks would look at it, and it's very complicated whether things are or not a conflict, but that could be a potential conflict, yes.
All right, thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could just add
Representative Stutz.
This bill does not determine whether or not an individual is conflicted out. All this bill says is if you are found to have been conflicted out, you may still continue to participate in the discussion. You just may not vote on the issue.
Thank you, Representative Stutz. Senator Klayman.
So one of the areas that the public often asks about the legislature is if people have conflicts and they keep voting because somebody declares a conflict and then there's an objection and they're told they have to vote and they have to push the button. And the public sometimes doesn't understand that. The notion with this is that they'll be able to participate in the discussion and their views be heard, but when it comes time to vote, they won't be able to vote.
That's correct, Senator Klayman.
What about
follow-up, Senator Klayman?
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. What happens if the board wants to go back and deliberate before they announce their decision? Can they participate in the deliberation that might be private deliberation, or are they only allowed to participate in the public discussion?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, they would be allowed to participate in the total discussion. They just would not be allowed to vote. And that is one of the beauties of this bill is there wouldn't be any need to have a discussion that isn't a public discussion because this individual would be legitimately participating in the discussion. Currently, it's not to say that those discussions don't have or occur. They're just not occurring in the public transparently.
Thank you.
So we have online Art Nelson. He is the executive director of the Board of Fisheries. And there was a question that Senator Myers had that needed expertise. Mr. Nelson, could you please put yourself on the record with your affiliation and answer Senator Myers' question?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for having me today. My name is Art Nelson. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Fisheries. And to the question that Senator Myers asked earlier, I am not aware of any time that the board lost quorum due to, you know, more than three members being conflicted out on any time. It does occasionally. There have been some times when two members have been conflicted out on certain proposals, and the board always needs four votes in the affirmative to carry any motion. And so it makes things a little more complicated in those situations. But as Representative Stutz pointed out earlier, this bill would not change anything about when a conflict does or does not exist. So,
was that sufficient, Senator Myers?
Yes, thank you.
Senator Kawasaki.
Yes, thank you. For Mr. Nelson, we were just discussing the kinds of conversations that people might have at the Board of Fish. Is the Board of Fish under the Open Meeting Act law?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, yes, as the board is.
Okay. No follow-up. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Mr. Nelson? Yes, Senator Myers.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not sure if this is for Mr. Nelson or for the bill sponsor, but I guess just playing devil's advocate a smidge here. If we run into so many conflicts of interest, I guess part of the question is why do we necessarily appoint people that, you know, you can probably tell beforehand we're going to have some conflicts of interest. Why don't we change our appointment process or look for different candidates?
Mr. Greening?
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I think the desire is to get people on the board that have the knowledge, that have the expertise. A lot of these, the way these hunts and fisheries are prosecuted are very nuanced depending on the fishery, the region. And so the desire is that you have people on the board with expertise. And you kind of hit the nail on the head, which is that we have folks that are extremely qualified that have stopped putting their name forward because they say, what is the point? I mean, I think Board Chairman John Jensen in 2018, he was conflicted out of one third of the proposals in Southeast Finfish. And so you've ended up with a situation where more often than not, in our Rep Stutz's capacity as fisheries chair, we engage with folks talking about board appointments. I can't tell you how many times we've heard people say, I don't want to put my name in for that because I'm just going to be conflicted out. I'd rather just be out fishing or doing something else with my time. So I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Senator Kawasaki. I guess
who wouldn't rather be out fishing? I did have a just sort of a point to make was that, like, when Board of Fish appointees, Board of Game appointees come before this committee, in fact, Senate Resources or House Resources, we always ask them what their experience is. And I think that there was a guy the number of years ago, Board of Game, he wasn't a real active hunter. He wasn't one of the people who uses a guided service. He wasn't a guide himself. But he's a photographer, and people said, oh, well, he's just a photographer now, and so we can't – he's unqualified to be on this Board of Game. And I think when we talk about it, we kind of want to see people that have that experience. And I don't know why it is that we – that they weren't allowed to, it's under the Executive Branch Ethics Act, be able to speak about the experience that they bring. I definitely think they shouldn't vote, but I don't know if I – anyways, that's probably under discussion on the bill eventually.
Thank you. Mr. Greening, did you have a comment?
I have, through the chair, Madam Chair, I have one addition to Senator Kawasaki's previous question, which is there are a variety of ways that somebody would be conflicted out of. Like, for example, if somebody was a board member of the Chitna Dipners Association and that association was advocating for or against a certain proposal, that board member would be conflicted out. And so there's a variety of things you look at, and I think the same goes true for Senator Rauscher's question. It would really depend on the advocacy of that business or that board, whether there was a perceived benefit to be received. And it's interesting to note that in the personal interest statutes that it's the last part of the definition or is anything of value, which is pretty broad. And I think one of the reasons this has been such an issue for commercial fishermen is that it's extremely easy to prove a $5,000 value threshold when it comes to permits that are monetized. And so it has been something that has been disproportionately applied on a certain user group. And so that's why we're kind of seeking to level the playing field.
Thank you.
And to
Representative Stutz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, through the chair, to Senator Kawasaki. We view it the way you do. It's not reasonable to exclude them from the discussion, but it is very reasonable to exclude them from the vote.
All right. So Mr. Nelson is online. Were there further questions for the Executive Director of the Board of Fisheries? All right, seeing none, thank you, Mr. Nelson, for being available and helpful today at the meeting. We will now have invited testimony. There are two invited testifiers. I will make them aware that we have 15 minutes left in the meeting. First, I will call on Nate Rose. He is the vice president of the Kodiak Saners Association. Mr. Rose, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon. Can you guys hear me? My connection okay?
Yes, it's great. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm on the boat, so I'm one of those guys that would just rather go fishing, but I'm here. So.
All right.
Members of the Senate Resources Committee for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Nate Rose, and on behalf of the Kodiak Saners Association, I appreciate the opportunity to provide comments and request your support regarding conflict of interest policies and participation on the Alaska Board of Fisheries, otherwise known as the House Bill 33. Kodiak is a home to a diverse and highly active commercial fishing fleet. Many of our members, including myself, participate across multiple fisheries throughout the year, including salmon, crab, cod, herring, rockfish, and halibut, most of which fall under the purview of the Board of Fish for regulatory reasons. This broad participation provides fishermen with a comprehensive year-round understanding of how management decisions in one fishery can directly and indirectly affect others, as well as coastal Alaskan economies and the stability of our communities. Within our region, the extremely complex Kodiak Area Salmon Management Plan serves as a foundational framework for responsible and successful participation in our salmon fishery. A working knowledge of the plan and of the regulatory structures governing other fisheries is essential for those of us who operate on the water. Management plans are not easily understood by the general public or even by longstanding Board of Fish members. And as a result, the individuals most qualified to serve on the board are often those with direct hands-on experience and familiarity with the practical impacts of regulatory decisions. However, under the current conflict of interest framework, many of these highly qualified individuals would likely face recusal from deliberations on matters where our expertise is most relevant. In small coastal communities like Kodiak, the pool of experienced, knowledgeable individuals is inherently very limited. The fishermen with the deepest understanding of the fisheries are often the same individuals whose livelihoods are directly tied to them. When those individuals would be unable to participate in board deliberations, the board loses valuable insight that cannot be easily replaced. While public testimony is an essential component of the regulatory process, it is not equivalent to participation in board deliberations. Board members often listen to hundreds of testimonies, and at times the factual implications of a proposal are lost between the time of testimony and the time of deliberation. The opportunity to participate in deliberation, even without the ability to make motions or vote, allows experienced members to answer questions, provide context, clarify intent, and help ensure that the record reflects practical realities on the fishing grounds. This level of engagement strengthens transparency and improves the quality of the decision-making process. We recognize and respect the importance of maintaining integrity and public trust in the board's process, and at the same time, policy should not unintentionally discourage knowledgeable fishermen from accepting appointments. Kodiak and other coastal communities depend on a limited number of individuals who possess the experience, willingness, and capacity to serve on the Board of Fisheries. If those individuals are effectively sidelined, the long-term result is a board that is less connected to the fisheries and communities it's governing. Decisions affecting Alaska's fisheries are strongest when informed by those who live and work in them year-round. Thank you for your time and for your service to Alaska. I've really appreciated the questions you guys have had for the bill sponsor, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Rose. Are there questions for Mr. Rose? Seeing none, thank you very much for taking time out to speak to us today. Next up under invited testimony is Bruce Schachtler. There we go. He is calling in from Kodiak. Mr. Schachtler.
Yes, ma'am, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, my name is Bruce Schachtler. I've been a commercial fisherman for the last 50 years. And I reside in Kodiak the entire time and sometime before that. I'm an everyday, all-day subsistence user, an avid sport fisherman, and a boat-owning, permit-holding commercial fisherman, and a father of three great kids. I'm here representing myself and I believe all the folks that I interact with every day in the stream or on the docks. I'm here to help support HB 33, which by its very title shows the broad legislative and public support through its passing over to you from the House of Representatives, where it was passed last year. I have participated in many fisheries in every area, from Ketchikan to Nome and out to Dutch Harbor. During that time, I've been intimately involved in the Board of Fish meetings addressing all of the fisheries in all of those areas as an active testifier, regulation proposer for those fisheries. This bill, HB 33, addresses just one single issue on the board that was clearly not addressed when the board was formed 50 years ago. When the fisheries of the world was a different place, before limited entry was firmly in place and mature, before the great regime change of weather and fish species in 1977, and before some of the fisheries that we have now were even part of the present array of Alaska fisheries. The issue addressed in HB 33 is that a board member with a perceived conflict that may seem to be even remotely, indirectly, theoretically financial or personal is excluded from discussing the subject at hand as a participating board member, even though that member was appointed and confirmed by the legislature for that exact expertise that is assumably and somewhat unique among board members. That unique knowledge is what is most needed during the complicated discussions as the board develops and decides new regulations, regulations that change lives. Without that unique experience and knowledge available to the board, these life-changing decisions may not be based on all the information needed and available to make the best and most accurate or reality-based decisions. Fish migration, its ever-changing patterns, fishing gear technicalities, there are many changes over the years, and the reality of everyday practices on the fishing grounds by individual fishery or gear is not something that a sitting board member can always get from the emotional, pressurized, often conflicting, and hurried public testimony. It is imperative that the board member that was appointed and confirmed for that same knowledge is available to the board as a whole when it's mostly needed. The short 3-minute testimony allowed to the conflicted board member as a public participant is simply not the same, nor is it adequate as a direct interactive discussion with fellow board members at the exact time when they may need it the most, which is during the critical time of immediate decision. I don't believe that there's a deliberative body anywhere that could responsibly and effectively carry on their duties under this scenario. As a real and occurring example I've experienced in the last few years at board meetings, there have been member statements declaring their confusion on an issue that is presently under consideration and their reluctance to vote because of that confusion. HB 33 would make that needed information immediately available, transparent to everyone, and will help prevent this sort of crippling confusion. I also want to remind the committee and stress the fact that HB 33 only allows the potentially conflicted member to provide this expertise. It does not give them the ability to vote. I appreciate you letting me come in and tell you this, and I'll be here for any questions at any time, now or in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schachtler, for your testimony. Are there any questions for him? Seeing none, thank you very much for being available this afternoon. All right. With that, we are going to set this bill aside for future deliberation. It is not noticed for public testimony today. I'm looking to my staff. It was not noticed for public testimony today. By design, obviously, we have 7 minutes left in the meeting, and we anticipated it would take much of the time. So thank you, Board, committee members for being present today. I want to thank Senators Dunbar and Wilikowski, who have been online for the entire meeting. They had the opportunity to text if they had any questions, and they did not have any. At this time, that concludes our agenda for today, but I am setting an amendment deadline for another bill. It's Senate Bill 158, entitled Cook Inlet, New Administrative Area, otherwise known possibly as the SETNET bill, keeping in line with fisheries. That amendment deadline will be Monday, March 2nd at noon. So this concludes our meeting for today. The next meeting will be Monday, March 2nd at 3:30 p.m. At that time, we're going to have a presentation on the bonding authority of ADA by Randy Raro, and we will be taking up Senate Bill 158, Cook Inlet, New Administrative Area. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. Let the record reflect the time is 4:55 p.m. Mm-hmm.